listener. Listening to Darling Shine, a podcast by myself, Elodie Pullen,
and me, Chloe Fisher.
A place where we ground womanhood's unspoken experiences from grief to fertility and everything in between.
Join us while we transform our pain into power, encompassing all emotions, ugly and beautiful. Darling Shine is your chosen family and your survival kit for the unexpected shit life throws at you. We have got the beautiful Bridget Huswaite on the podcast today. Now, Bridget is a music presenter, a podcaster, an author. But today, outside of all that, we're actually chatting about endometriosis because it is Endometriosis Awareness Month this March. And here on Darling Shine, we're all about advocating for yourself and talking about these hard to talk about topics. I was actually on Bridget's podcast, maybe 6 months ago or something, and spoke about my journey and all of the rest, which you guys are sick of hearing about. So today, and as you know as well, I had a bit of endo too, but because my endo is silent, I haven't really been able to talk about it properly, but it is such a massive topic. I have read your book and your story just literally brought tears to my eyes because I was so unaware of how extreme this condition is. So welcome to the podcast, Bridget, and we're really excited to have you on here today.
Thank you so much. It's nice to meet you, Elodie. I feel like I've known you through kind of Instagram and everything, so it's really cool to meet you. And yeah, so great to see you, Chloe, because the last time we chatted was on my podcast and it was about all of your struggles. And I just need to say, to see your post on Christmas Day was like, it literally made so many people's Christmas. It made my Christmas out. I remember I was in bed, opened up my Instagram and I saw your post. I was like, fuck yes.
Today's going to be a good day.
Yeah, like you're Santa.
Literally,
Santa. Yeah.
I remember Chloe being like, should I announce on Christmas Day? I was like,
absolutely.
You literally make the entire world's whole Christmas just so much better.
Yeah, and I don't think you realize like how like much of an impact it was. Like it was, people are so invested in your story. So like it brought so much joy. Like, yeah, stoked for you, man. So stoked.
Thank you.
Good.
Yay.
Obviously endo sucks and it can be it is really debilitating in your case. Like we're going to get into just how crazy painful it is and how much it's affected your life. But can you just start by just like telling us what is endo?
Yes. And I love that this is a starting question because it's so important to really understand what it is because, you know, despite affecting like 1 in 9 Australians, there's so much information out there and it's really frustrating on an advocacy front to like feel like you're constantly correcting people. By definition, endometriosis is a chronic condition where tissue similar to the lining of the uterus. So we call the lining of the uterus the endometrium, but it's not that tissue. It's got similar, I guess, characteristics, but it's actually a different kind of tissue and it grows outside of the uterus. So it doesn't affect the uterus. There's another condition called adenomyosis, which is kind of like endo's crazy cousin, which happens within the uterus, but endo occurs outside of the uterus and it can cause organs to like stick together. It can obviously cause a lot of pain and inflammation in up to 50% of people with endo. It can cause infertility and yeah, there's no known cause or cure. So it's pretty hectic stuff.
Okay. I loved that explanation. I've always thought it was inside the uterus.
Right.
I thought endo was inside the uterus. So because it's outside, does it like manipulate the shape and the way that the uterus is?
Yeah, well, it can affect fertility in that like it can still, you know, affect your fallopian tubes and stuff. And also the fertility front, I'm still kind of like wrapping my head around it. It's like pretty much three ways in which it can affect it. But in terms of like the uterus, the poor uterus just cops so much blame, but it doesn't actually have any endo. So when we talk about the uterus in terms of like people are often told they need a hysterectomy to cure their endo, and that's not true because like by removing the uterus, you're not removing endo because it's not in there. If you have adenomyosis, a hysterectomy is a cure. But if it's endo, it doesn't really make a difference? Like, I think there's been some people who have said like that some of their symptoms have been eased a bit with a hysterectomy, but then there's also people who have had a hysterectomy and they're still in debilitating pain. So factually, removing the uterus hysterectomy doesn't cure endometriosis because, yeah, it's actually been found in every major organ of the body, which is just another wild thing because you don't actually think that. I think the way in which we talk about endo is that it just concerns like the reproductive, the pelvic cavity. But I've had friends who have had endo in their diaphragm. Like it's been found in like the nasal lining. There's been some rare cases, yeah, that it's even been found in cisgender men, like super rare, but it's still really important to highlight that. So I kind of have like a weird relationship with the language around endo and it, you know, it is mostly women, but I just don't feel comfortable coining it as like a reproductive, as solely a reproductive issue, or just like in terms of gynecology and even women's health to an extent, because I think it's like it is factually a whole body disease. But the thing is that we don't treat it like it is. And that just opens another, you know, can of worms. There's a whole other conversation about, yeah, how we approach the language and the treatment, because it does affect the way in which people are treated for their endo, which is very different for everyone.
So you first got your period when you were 15 years old, and this is when it sort of started happening for you, right? You were at school, you got this really heavy, really painful period. 15, you're young. Like, I don't think I had my period at 15.
Yeah.
But when you're going through that, did you think that this was normal?
Well, it was actually the first doctor's appointment that I had was when I was 15 about my period. So I got it. I actually got my period the first week of high school. So I would have actually been like 12, which is pretty full on, because I was a year younger than everyone, and that was 2003. So I remember the first week of school, and I remember getting it and being like, "Oh my god, I'm growing up! I get a little liner in my underwear." But then I kind of quickly, like as each month went on, kind of quickly realized, like, this is not fun. And then by the time I was 14, 15, so like I think year 9, year 10-ish, my mum was like, "We should probably go to the doctor, because I've got like a twin sister, I've got an older sister, and their periods like weren't as heckers as mine."
So your twin, does she suffer with any of this?
No.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm the only one in the family with a diagnosis. I think my older sister might actually have PCOS, but yeah, my mum was just like, you know, this isn't particularly normal. And my flow, like I had really heavy periods in high school, and it was just mortifying, because it's like every time I got up from sitting down in class, and like I was petrified that I would be like, there was a few times that I did like leak through my dress. I would have to wear like 2 or 3 pairs of undies. Like, girly had to layer up with like a super pad. Like, it was just really embarrassing. You
know? Yeah. I remember at school, like, I mean, your flow is obviously another level, but do you remember how every time we'd hop up at school, we'd be like, can you check the back of my dress? Check my dress, check my dress. It was like a thing. Did you ever have that?
I'm pretty sure I didn't get my period until I was like the last person, like year 11 or year 12.
And then you just got boobs overnight. It was psycho.
I don't know. I was a very late bloomer. I was like a child until I was in year 12 at school. I think it was pretty embarrassing. I remember I got my period. I was like, yes.
Finally,
I've joined the club. And then,
you just got these enormous boobs overnight. But no, I did have to leave school a few times with period on the back of my dress. Fucking embarrassing.
No. And just like having to wrap your jumper around the back of your dress constantly. Yes. Like, it was exhausting.
They literally don't talk about endo at school. How does that make you feel? Does that like make you frustrated?
Oh, it's so frustrating, man. I think a lot's changed since, you know, I was in high school. There's a really great program in Australia called the Pep Talk. So it's like pelvic pain, endometriosis, periods. And it's a school program that goes around to high schools, and it includes the guys, which is really important, because I think it's, you know, they need to be aware so we can normalize the convo. But they pretty much teach you about it. It's government funded. But yeah, in terms of the health curriculum, you know, when we were in school, absolutely not. Like, didn't know endo existed, didn't know it was even a word. So it would have made a world of difference if I had some sort of knowledge. Even going to the doctor, you know, when I was in 15, it was such a generic consultation. They were like, "It's time for you to go on the pill." Like, that was just the natural next step, and as if that would fix it. But it doesn't. Like, you know, in terms of birth control or contraception, if we're talking like the pill or the Mirena, you know, that can kind of work more so as a band-aid, in that it can help in symptom management, but in terms of like this disease growing inside you, it does fuck all, you know? And for me, the pill didn't even help with my pain. Like I was still in pain.
Oh, but oftentimes the pill does kind of balance your flow, and then sometimes it does manage the pain. Hey, so it just masks the fact yes. that a lot of women are growing up with endo that they probably could have figured out when they were 15.
Totally.
Not that you want to be like going under the knife that young, but like you probably could have at 15 and figured this out way earlier, right? Rather than masking it on the pill.
Totally. Yep. 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 And that's the thing. Like most of us do get, like most of us have got endo when we're teenagers. Like when you first get those symptoms, like it's a pretty clear indication. And I get like how invasive the procedure is of going in and, you know, them removing disease, but it doesn't help when it's, you know, when you're kind of delaying it and then you're being told that like the pill and the Mirena don't do anything to manage the actual disease itself. Yes, it can help relieve pain, but like at the end of the day, this is a chronic condition. If the longer you leave the disease, like the deeper it can embed itself into your organs. Like when I had my first surgery, so like fast forward to when I'm 27, and it was pretty widespread across, you know, my bowel, my bladder, my pouch of Douglas, my pelvic sidewalls. But if I'd left it any longer, the surgeon said they would have had to remove part of my bowel at the age of 27. Like it's terrifying, right?
So do you think your life would be so much different if they had have found this at 15 and not 27?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And there's a lot of grief with that, I think. You know, one thing for me, especially the last few years, just even in the conversations that I've had on my podcast, and I think just like navigating my 30s is kind of understanding post-diagnosis the grief that can come with, you know, having something like endo that is chronic and has no cure. I think when I did get my diagnosis, which took 12 years, you know, from that moment that I went to a doctor for the first time at 15 to when I'm 27, I was really excited to have that diagnosis. Really excited, actually. I was like, oh my God, a validation. Like I've got answers. I'm so keen to talk about this. But as the years have gone on for me, the biggest thing has kind of been like, shit, the more that I sit with it, the more I can kind of see how I'm grieving what could have been, like what could have been my quality of life had I been diagnosed, you know, in high school. I think the kind of the medical gaslighting that so many people endure from being told that it's all in your head. I had one doctor that literally said to me, to my face when I was 26, yeah, a year before my diagnosis, she was like, you don't have endometriosis, others have it worse than you. Beyond the physical stuff, I think there's a huge emotional toll with an invisible illness like endometriosis. So if I had got my diagnosis when I was 15, there's a lot that I probably wouldn't have to endure.
I think that there's a lot of misinformation around it, and B, a lot of doctors, like they don't specialize in endometriosis, so they don't know the extremity of it. Like that's so frustrating. Even, I mean, with me, I didn't know I had it until I had a laparoscopy when I was struggling to fall pregnant in 2021. And he was like, you've got stage 3 endo, but luckily for me, I didn't have any symptoms or anything like that. But yeah, I don't know. It's so frustrating because you go round and round in circles with doctors and, you know, they're diagnosing you with this and diagnosing you with that. And it's just like, the system is sometimes a little bit.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're made to believe period pain is just normal and that we just need to put up with it.
Totally, totally. And I think as well, a lot of the symptoms overlap with other conditions like adenomyosis, PCOS. A lot of people get, you know, misdiagnosed with like irritable bowel syndrome because yeah, there's so many kind of flags to look out for with endo. But I think it also just comes down to that power dynamic between like patient and medical professional. And what I really hate is, and I'm not saying all doctors, but there's a lot of ego. And I think there's a lot of ego when you come in and you say you think you might have something and it's something that the doctor may not actually know much about, because not only is there so much, you know, there's a lack of education within schools and like within wider society and in media and stuff, but also within the medical field. Like we can't expect medical professionals and GPs to literally know every medical condition under the sun off the top of your head. Like that's impossible. Like unless you're like got a freak of a memory, but I think that's okay. Like for me, if I went in and spoke to a doctor and they're like, I would much rather them be like, hey, I'm not really across this, but let me refer you to someone else. Like that's just what I never got. And I think I would respect that person in front of me, that medical professional, so much more if they just like admitted that they didn't have the knowledge or the tools to help me, but they could like pass me on to someone else that could help me. I think a lot of us don't experience that when that's really what we deserve as patients.
100%. And I feel like potentially maybe some doctors hate it when I imagine people coming in and going, I'm in so much pain. I really think I've got endometriosis. And I think sometimes, I mean, doctors are fucking amazing. Obviously we need them, but maybe they're like looking at us going, hey, mate, you're not the doctor. Like, don't be fucking self-diagnosing. Like, they don't like that. They don't want to be told what.
Yeah. Quickly on that, Elodie, like the amount of people that I've had that have messaged me and been like, I've taken your book into doctor's appointments. Like, I reckon doctors hate me. Like, I reckon so much of the medical system hates me because I've like put this book out that people are taking in and they're like, oh, well, actually. And I'm just like, I've even been like to the emergency department once and I've had a copy of my book on standby in case, like, sadly anticipating that I would be dismissed if I'm in immense pain, ready to whip it out and be like, I know what I'm talking about. And it's so sad though. Like, but yeah.
Can we talk about the pain? I want you to explain. I mean, look, can you try and go back to one of those moments where you're having one of those really, really excruciating periods for someone who maybe hasn't seen a doctor and thinks that this is normal? What is this pain feeling like?
Yeah, well, it is different for a lot of people. And when I was kind of putting together how to endo, I put out call outs on my Instagram being like, describe your endo pain to me and what it feels like, because I really want to kind of paint a picture so people can understand what it can possibly feel like. And I was pretty taken aback by some of the responses because they were like gruesome. Like people were literally like, it's like barbed wire wrapped around, you know, they'll say like wrapped around my uterus or like a hot rod up there. Like it's very graphic and confronting. For me, it's mostly in the lead up to my period. I'm actually also currently navigating a potential PMDD diagnosis because on the emotional side of things are grim. That's just a whole different conversation. But on the physical front, my pain kind of originates as like a real dull but super present aching cramp. Like it feels really deep. It feels hot, like, you know, when we say flare-ups, it kind of feels like your insides are on fire. And for me, it has extended up into, like, my abdomen. And that was really confusing as well throughout my diagnostic journey because I was getting, like, these really intense cramps up in my stomach and didn't have an answer for it. But since my diagnosis for endo and since doing more research and having stints in the emergency department, I've come to realize that pain can stem from cysts bursting. So I've had a few instances, they're called hemorrhagic cysts, and they're pretty much blood-filled cysts. They're kind of just like, they just go off. They're like bombs. They just blow up inside you. And, you know, in some cases, the blood I don't really know what happens to it. Like with mine, the blood hasn't been like so crazy where they've had to go in and like drain some of it. But for some people, they have to like have surgery after a hemorrhagic cyst. Like it's really full on. But yeah, for me, it's like the dull, achy cramps in terms of that pain, but it's also the fatigue, like the chronic fatigue and the exhaustion of, I guess it's essentially like your body's just like trying to fight against this disease that's going on inside, but no one can see that on the external. So, you know, by face value, I look
perfectly
somewhat
healthy
or normal or whatever that means. But like internally, it's just chaos. And it's also, for me, it's been like painful bowel movements. It's been the urgency to pee. Like I always had joked that I have the bladder of like an 84-year-old. Those have been the main things for me. Oh, painful sex as well. Like, you know, I lost my virginity when I was 18 and like it was painful. But then I remember like one night I had to drive back to my house from my first boyfriend's house because I was in that much pain. Like I was crawled up and I just couldn't stay there. Like I just needed to go home. And I was like, man, I know sex meant to hurt like the first couple of goes, but like this is pretty full on and I don't want to do it.
And
like,
it was happening every time.
Yeah, like it was really bad. Yeah, when I was like 18, 19, 20. But it's just like over the course of those 12 years of trying to get a diagnosis, all these little things are happening and you don't think to link them because we have grown up, you know, being told about mostly our period, but then you're at the doctor and they're just like, go on the pill, like it's just fine, or like that's just what you're meant to go through. So it's very confusing.
Do you know why it sort of seems to flare up just before your period? If it's like a full body thing and it's like present always.
Is it just that time of month or is it a lot of, like, is it all month? Like, are you always in kind of pain? Like, is sex always painful? Like, it's never not.
My main symptom is in the lead up to my period. But for other people, some people don't even have painful periods. Like you mentioned with silent endo, like some people just go without any symptoms, which like, you know, is good, but it's also kind of scary in the way that like you've been going on for so long and you're like, shit, like, you know, I would have got this checked out if I had some sort of indication earlier, because you don't want to get to that point where disease can just be like really widespread and like deep and infiltrating. But yeah, like it doesn't matter what time of month, if like in terms of painful sex, it's not painful every time now. I think I've just kind of come to manage, you know, if me and my partner are having sex and it hurts in one position, we'll just try another one or we'll just stop. But I just don't know until we do it. I think that's been the frustrating thing, is like, yeah, just not knowing when the pain will happen. I remember like after my first surgery, when I was diagnosed, they put in the Mirena. And unfortunately for me, the Mirena didn't help with symptom management. And I was actually in more pain after that. So I had the Mirena for 18 months, not nearly 2 years. And then I got it removed in my second endo surgery and it was sideways in my cervix. So it was like wanting to get the fuck out of there anyway. But yeah, it's not exclusive to like, you know, leading up to that time of month. It can really happen anytime. And for other people, yeah, they may not have symptoms down there, but they might have chest pain if they've got like endo in their diaphragm or whatever. It's just, yeah, it's annoying because there's so much to think about and it is hard on an education front trying to explain that to people. And it's also hard in terms of treatment because it's primarily gynecologists who are dealing with it, but they're not. And I feel like all gynecologists probably hate me, but like, we need to have people like they do in America and in India and in Canada, where there is just endometriosis specialists and all they do is deal with people with endo, PCOS and adenomyosis. They're not delivering babies and removing disease. Like there's just...
How do we not have that?
I don't know. This is a whole other conversationality and it's like, it's one that really grinds my gears, because on an advocacy front, it's really frustrating when, you know, the organizations in Australia, the endo organizations, like they know that there's a lot of dissatisfaction within like the patient community, because that's what we're asking for. Like we're getting funding for research and stuff, and that's great, but I don't think we're going to find a cure anytime soon. So I would love to see focus on what we can do now. And that is ensuring that people are all getting the right surgery, because you've probably also read stories of people with endo who have like 10 plus surgeries. And that's just not what should be, like, you shouldn't be going through that many surgeries for endo. It should really be like one surgery done right, the disease removed correctly, which is being removed from the root, which is what we call excision surgery, as opposed to ablation.
Ablation? Yeah, I had that. And then when I went to America, she's just like, this is a bit of a, like, because I had that in Australia. And then she's like, nah, it has to be taken out by the root.
No way.
Yeah. And then when I had the surgery for Asherman syndrome in LA, yeah, they were like, oh, it pretty much all has to be redone, because you actually have to cut it out and take it out by the root, as opposed to just burning it.
Yes.
I think that my diagnosis was way less. Yeah, they didn't find as much as that. Like, it was way worse than what they originally thought, basically.
Because does it just keep growing back if you don't get the root surgery?
Yeah, so I guess think of it like a weed, right? So, you know, excision is like a shovel where it's getting it out from the root, all of it's gone.
Yes.
So the chance of recurrence is really low, really low.
And you've had that or no?
It's kind of confusing. So my first surgery, because it was through the public health system, and this is the thing, like the inequality in treatment, like it, literally the kind of surgery you have pretty much depends on what you can afford. So the first surgery I had, I didn't have private health insurance, and it was through the public system, and they were like, well, you can have it for free and you just have to wait 5 months if the gynecologist or whatever can supervise students, basically. Like, so I was like, whatever, I'll be a guinea pig. Cause I didn't realize, like, had I known how bad my endo was, I probably would have been like, nah, I'll probably pay and get like the specialist to do it. I can't take it back. And it's, you know, how else are you going to learn? Like, I've made peace exactly with that, right? So I was happy to be the guinea pig, but they were learning how to remove it correctly, but they didn't get it all out. So come around to my second surgery through the private health system with an endometriosis specialist. So all he does is just operate and deal with people with endo. He doesn't, you know, deal with babies, and he's not doing this juggling act. Like, he's done all the training, the accreditation, the hours in surgery. And yeah, he went in there and he was like, none has grown. There's no new endo. This just wasn't removed correctly in the first place. So he got that out. The thing is, though, I don't know if I need another surgery until I go in and they open me up.
They can't tell you. They can't tell you other than going under.
You have to have this.
Yeah, you can't just go to a doctor and they can't just look at you, or you can't tell them your symptoms. Like, they physically can't tell you how bad it is or what stage you have unless they stick a camera in and go in.
So, and also cut it out and take it off to pathology for testing, you know. So there are some ultrasounds. Some ultrasounds can pick up deep infiltrating endometriosis, but they also can't. So I had those scans before my first surgery and they didn't pick anything up. So I was a bit defeated. I was like, well, God damn it, like what now? But thankfully the GP that I saw at that point, she was like, it's still worth going to look at the possibility of surgery, which is what I did. And then they went in there and they're like, sheesh, like there's some endo up in here. So yeah.
So
I feel, am I like making your brain explode, Elodie and Chloe? Because it's just so much to absorb.
I totally, like, I get it all, because I've essentially done so much of this research on behalf of myself, you know, because you got to do it for yourself, otherwise no one else is going to do it. I mean, it might be blowing Elodie's mind, but
I remember when you like they had no idea whether you had endo or not, but you just had to have this surgery. And I remember finding it crazy that they couldn't, like, it's like, fuck, I just thought ultrasounds would be able to see that. And then they'd look inside and they'd be like, oh, you've got heaps of scar shit in there and tissue and all that jazz, and cutting out all this stuff that they wouldn't have been able to see. So is it like every year or two you just basically have to book in for surgery just to see how it's going in there? Is that like a...
Well, that's the other thing. It's so hard, because it's like you don't want to have to go in and have another surgery and then, you know, they find that there's nothing. Because what happens with a lot of people, especially when we're going like 5+ surgeries, 10+ surgeries, like I know some people have had 17, which is just terrible. Wow. The more you have surgery, the more adhesions and scar tissue is created,
that's what
right?
ended up with me, and you end up with Asherman syndrome.
Right.
And your uterus actually does stick together. In the end, it's hectic.
Well, it creates a new cycle of pain. So that creates a whole different issue separate to endo. But then a lot of people with endo think that is endo. So then they just keep going in. And then they also, what doesn't help is if they're going to someone who doesn't even know how to remove it correctly, and they're telling them, yep, you just need to come in every 18 months and have a new surgery. Like, that is such a red flag. If you're being told that, run and go find another medical professional and get a second opinion, because it's not normal to be going in having routine surgeries. Like I said, it should be one surgery
done right. That sounds like a bloody moneymaker to me.
Yes, it is. I literally had a gynecologist off the record tell me that she knows a group of surgeons who just love the money, and they just will keep doing surgeries because they get that gap payment or whatever. Like, it's crook, hey?
They're fucking running a business. That's it. Like,
but it doesn't surprise me. Like, that's the sad thing.
They're running a bloody business.
It's so heavy.
Like, but this is like people's lives are severely affected by it. Like, it can ruin someone's life, you know?
And it's also as well that another frustrating thing too, it's like it can't always just be operated on this day. It has to like be in within, does it have to be within cycle and like this day of the month or whatever, or can it be Because I know that with mine, when I had mine, it was like it had to be literally on day XYZ. Otherwise, you had to wait till the next cycle.
They don't recommend having it whilst you get your period. The first surgery that I had was so annoying. It was literally like the day or two before my period was it came. Fuck, what happened though? I think they gave me... I reckon I took some sort of pill. I went to the chemist and I got my Mirena, and I reckon I went and got some sort of pill as well to take that may have like reduced the bleeding for me or something. I don't know if the blood just makes it might make it harder for them to detect the endo, because endo, this is another thing, like endo, there's like, it doesn't just come in like one standard like color or whatever, like it can be like white, there's been like blue endo, there's been red endo, like it's hard to like, not, you know, your regular gynecologist or whatever can't just detect all kinds of endo.
It's so frustrating.
So maybe the blood like affects the visibility of it, or maybe it makes it more painful post-surgery waking up. I don't know, but they do recommend not having your period, but they won't rule it out. Like they, you know, or maybe they have for some people. Like it really depends on who you see. Like there's so much inconsistency with the info.
Okay, so women that are listening and they're feeling that they've got endo, they're undiagnosed, where are they going? What are they? Who are they seeing and what are they saying?
Well, they're reading my fucking book first.
How to endo, guys. Go and get
it. Put it in our show notes as well.
Is it an audiobook as well, doll?
It is, and it's narrated by yours truly.
Yes.
So not some generic person, it me. Talking straight to you. I think the most important thing you can do is your research first, and I didn't do that prior to my diagnosis, which I wish I did. Like I joined a couple of Facebook groups and I was like, hey, I don't really know what to expect, because I went in fully trusting that I was going to be looked after. And then I found out all this information after my first surgery, like ablation versus excision. And then I was like, holy shit. And then I created Endogram to like put out the right information, because I didn't have those tools or resources accessible to me when I was navigating that kind of 12-year journey of answers. So I would highly recommend, you know, my book. There's also another really great book called Beating Endo, and that's been created by a pelvic floor physio and an excision specialist in America. So it's called Beating Endo.
Great.
It's quite technical, and my book, I guess, kind of aims to be a bit more of a simplified version, but also coming from like a patient perspective. So it's like information, but also like just comfort and guidance and whatever. But then I would also, just go to your GP. In my book, I have like a list of the kinds of questions that you should be asking, so you know like how you can kind of create that dialogue and how you can also kind of steer the conversation, because it's very easy once you get into a doctor's office, you just have a mind blank and you just say yes to whatever they're saying because of that power dynamic, you know?
100%. I go in wanting to ask five different problems, because I just save up all my shit for like this one doctor visit that I have every few months, and I'm like, got five different things I want to talk about, and I literally only remember one of them when I'm there.
So annoying.
True. Fucking kills me.
I know, right? And on that point too, I would also say that it is totally okay to go into a doctor's appointment or with your, you know, specialist, whoever that you're seeing, and write down things and even just say to them like, hey, you know, like this is really important to me and I just want to make sure that I'm across all the information. I'm just going to take some notes. They shouldn't have a problem with that. And if they do, red flag. But I think it's totally okay to do that. I think we just, absolutely, you know, and especially as women, like we just think that we can't, speak up or challenge things, and that we just have to be good and cooperative. But you are allowed to challenge and ask questions and get people to repeat things and get asked for clarification. So I think just, remembering, although that power dynamic's really scary, they're here to serve and to help you. Like you should have the power as the patient. So I guess that's in terms of the consultation and stuff. And like if you can, I mean, some of the organizations have groups where they will provide more info on recommending particular specialists and stuff. But it also, again, just comes down to like that access and the private versus public health situation, which is forever cooked. But I think the main thing is just doing your research so you do feel empowered by like the knowledge going into these consultations, as opposed to just like a deer in headlights like I was when I was just like naively, but also as you feel like you should be able to just go in and trust what you're being told.
Yeah, and have the expectation that you're probably going to have to see a specialist as opposed to your GP, right?
And push for that specialist 100%.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And also, like, if you end up being in a gynecologist's office, like, you know, you're allowed to ask, like, about, you know, how many surgeries do you perform and, like, what have you kind of found? Like, what's your experience? Like, I think it's a pretty daunting thing to ask, but you're entitled to know that information. Go on their website and see what training and accreditation they've done under RANSCOG, which is like the Royal Australian New Zealand college body for OB-GYNs and stuff, and what level they're at in terms of being able to perform this kind of surgery. You're allowed to know that information. So yeah, don't be afraid to like ask for more and just keep backing yourself. I think that was the biggest takeaway for me. Even though it took 12 years, like I knew that it wasn't right. And, you know, thankfully when I did have my diagnosis, I had a platform on Triple J at least that I could kind of talk about it. And hopefully that's in turn kind of like shortened the diagnosis duration for other people so they yes. don't have to go through it for 12 years.
We keep on talking about your diagnosis and you getting this diagnosis. It doesn't actually, does it stop at you've been diagnosed with endo, or is it continuous? Like where are you at now and what are you dealing with these days? Is it, have you still got symptoms or?
Yeah, it's a good one to highlight because I think you get the diagnosis and you're like, yay, but then you're like, oh, and now what? Because yes, you have answers, but because it's chronic and you can have a surgery, but that doesn't immediately remove the symptoms. It doesn't immediately mean you're going to have pain-free sex. It doesn't mean that you're immediately going to be relieved of fatigue and stuff. Then you got to kind of think about, okay, so how do I move forward with this and how do I navigate my life around endo? And for me, again, you know, entering my 30s, it's kind of hit different, I suppose, the more that I've sat with it. And, you know, if I think about my own maternal desires and where I want to go with that. I'm 32 now, turning 33 this year. And I have kind of been looking at that stuff in a different light in the sense that not only am I ready, but what's this going to mean for my pain management? Because, you know, there's been moments, well, honestly, every month, like I have to literally block out like 2 or 3 days in my calendar to just be at home and to just be in pain. So it kind of terrifies me. And I'm sure people will find this relatable. Like it terrifies me to think like, what the hell if I have a kid and I'm trying to look after this living being and I go into a flare or I have a cyst burst or I'm so fatigued that I can't even look after them because I can't look after myself. Like you can really fall into these real, like pretty dark thoughts about it and just being like, I just don't know if I can give myself to a child when like I'm in so much pain and I'm trying to figure this out. And yeah, it's really like, oh, it's such a mind fuck. And, you know, I know friends who have had kids and some of their symptoms have been better post-pregnancy, but I also know people who have had worse post-pregnancy. Again, it's so individualized. And I think that really scares me. Yeah, I don't know. And also living in a new state, like living in Perth now, like there's not as much access here to the kind of specialists that you can get over east. Like they're mostly on the east coast. I'm terrified if, you know, a day or night comes where I have a cyst burst and I have to end up in the emergency department here. Like I don't know what's going to happen and how they're going to treat me. The last time I went in was in Melbourne. It was actually during the last week of me being on Triple J and I had to miss a show in the last week because I had a cyst burst. The girl absolutely knew who I was because she like complimented this jumper that I was wearing. It was like a record label and she got me in straight away. I don't want to say I got special treatment, but like she knew like, you know, that I've got endo.
Yeah.
If I get shit treatment, I'll probably talk about it.
Fully.
But yeah, that's been the tricky thing, kind of navigating it in a new decade of life where you do, you know, you have that biological clock and that deadline. And, you know, I'm thinking about freezing my eggs next year and it's just a lot, you guys. It's a lot.
I feel for you. That really actually, like you said, you just look like a completely normal person from the outside. And it actually breaks my heart that it's so common because this story isn't just you. Like, it is so common in so many women, and it's like, wow.
It's so invisible.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around, you're having these surgeries, but it's not fixing the problem. Like, I can't understand why you're still in so much pain every month. Is there actually no cure for this?
No cure. And it's also important to remember that, like, you need to kind of adapt a multidisciplinary approach to the treatment and the pain management. So it doesn't just start and end with surgery. Something that I found really beneficial, and I'd recommend it to anyone, is pelvic floor physio. So going to see a pelvic floor physiotherapist, like, they usually do like manual examination, providing you consent to it, of course, because it is a bit of a,
I just had one the other day, actually, to test my pelvic floor. It's unusual. I was like, this is a nice, cool hand inside, finger just inside going in me. There. It's actually quite soothing. I was just like, this is nice.
It's so funny.
She had a really cold hand in a glove with lube on, and I was like, She's like, is this okay? I'm like, yeah, go for it. Sweet. Yeah. Don't be scared. Don't be scared.
And like, of course, if you're not comfortable, you don't have to do it. But I had a great pelvic floor physio in Melbourne, Alison.
We're like, yes, go for the internals.
Just get in there. Get a hand up, but it really helps. So, because they kind of press on the muscles, and it's like an internal, it sounds so crook, but it's like an internal massage. And that stuff's really important. Like, I know it actually is, it was really helpful for me. Thankfully, I'm in a position where I don't have to go. I was going weekly, fortnightly, but now it's just I haven't been in a really long time, actually. Some people will, make diet changes if they want to adapt a anti-inflammatory diet. I speak to a dietitian in my book who recommends embracing a Mediterranean diet because, eating, you still want to look after your body in terms of lifestyle and gentle exercise and stuff. And even sex, if you need to see a sexologist as well, it isn't just surgery, even though that is the gold standard for treatment. You still need to kind of embrace these other kind of elements and take a whole body holistic approach to it.
Wow. How it sounds like it affects your life in so many different ways. One of our friends from school actually has severe endo as well. And she has started the Bean protocol or something, and she's been doing the
heaps
literally
of people.
Just
eat. I don't know what this is.
Yes. Okay, heaps okay, so people send that to me about it's like a, you can it helps with fertility too, but
so
I never really
she
looked
went
into it too much.
So strict on this Bean thing. Lives in America, so maybe it's more beany protocol vibes over there. But for endo, maybe we're not doing it heaps in Oz for endo. But
what do you mean? Are we eating beans?
Beans. Beans is literally all she eats.
The bean protocol,
It's so heavy because she has to bring beans to work, beans, breakfast, lunch and dinner. Literally her nickname is McBean. And
it's giving freely the banana girl.
I feel weird. Even I don't have endo. I don't know. Potentially bean protocol's a thing we need to look into.
Yeah. Maybe also though, just get a vibe check from a doctor though. I don't want to be telling everyone to go ham on the beans. Bean OD.
Yes. Get the protocol and the doctor vibes first.
It's interesting because, I've had friends who have gone to see a naturopath and stuff and, again, emphasizing at the end of the day, it is so individualized. There's no one textbook way as to how to go with managing your symptoms and your pain. I mean, obviously the universal message is gold standard of treatment, which is getting the right surgery. But in terms of this is what I think, and I've noticed a lot in the patient community, there can be a lot of shaming others for doing things that work for them. I've seen it with people who are still people who are still on the pill or the Mirena because it helps, manage their symptoms, which is great and love that for them. I think at the end of the day, it always just comes down to what is true informed consent in terms of what is the information that you're being told surrounding this. So when I was told to get the Mirena, the doctor literally was the surgeon was this will, and I have it in paper, on my op notes, this will prevent future growth of endo, which is, it's not true. Yes, it can help in managing pain for some people, but it's not that's not informed, true informed consent to tell them that it's going to stop their endo because it's not true. So I think, at the end of the day, if you find something that works for you, that's more than okay. It's helping with your pain, that's good. But I think just always just understanding at the end of the day, endo factually is, you know, no known cause, no known cure. So many more questions than answers, but it doesn't help anyone to kind of just like rip other people to shreds for doing something that works for them. You know, like I was on THC and CBD for a while and I found that quite helpful. I had the vape and the oil drops and stuff, and that's like still weirdly controversial, but you know, what works for you.
But that took some of the pain off or the edge off the pain?
Yeah, it did. It did. But I actually had to stop taking it in my last year at Triple J because it affects your driving, and I had to be driving in, and it was just like, it was one of the reasons why I actually left. And I've spoken about it on my podcast, but my contract negotiations just weren't really supportive of my needs in terms of chronic pain management. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to quit them. So wow. I did.
Yeah, you've had a bit of a rough trot, sis.
Yeah. Well, it all worked out for the best. Like, love what I'm doing now, but it is in terms of people in the workplace, I think, you know, that can be really hard. People just feel like they're not being seen or supported. And for that to kind of happen to me, who was like publicly spoken about this stuff, I was like, well, fuck, like I feel bad for the people who feel like they don't have a voice with this stuff. So I guess that's why I still kind of, you know, want to talk about it.
Is that, yeah, I was going to say, that was my next question. What inspired you to be such a big advocate in the space?
Just because there was no one talking about it when I was going through that shit. And I was like, that sucks. So.
And you have that platform already. And you have that voice.
And also in the lead up to my surgery, like it was getting to the point where like, you know, when you and Paul came in, it got me on a good day where I wasn't in pain. But like, it got to the point where I had to take nights off, and I was like hunched over the desk and over the microphone with a heat pack, and you know, doing a 60-second talk break and playing some songs and just being in agonizing pain, like on the verge of tears. And I like, it got to the point where I had to be like, I need to talk about this because my listeners don't know why I'm like constantly calling in sick, and they probably think I'm just like some lazy bitch, but I'm just in a world of pain. And then, yeah, that's kind of how it all started. Like Hack, the current affairs program on Triple J that would be on before my show, fortunately were like, yeah, we'll talk about this. So I was like, sweet. And then it just took off from there. So I just kept kind of talking about it. And yeah, I guess, cause yeah, when you have that kind of platform, you know, you don't have to talk about it because it is such a personal thing. But I think for me, it was just like, there's no way that this should be normal. Like, in what world should we accept like a 12-year diagnostic duration?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's no way that you're alone as well.
Yeah. Just comforting to find those people to talk to, make new friendships, just have that level of understanding. And even like the guys who would like listen to Triple J, like the amount of guys and boyfriends and shit who have messaged me being like, oh, I heard you talk about it. Like we had it on in the trade shop. And yeah, it just made me really like understand my sister or my partner's pain. And like,
oh, I love
and,
like, the boy accent that you put. Yeah. I really love you in general because you say all the words I say. You say cooked, you say crook. Like, I feel like we are one in the same.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's but yeah, that was like, that was so comforting and almost more rewarding because it is so isolating, and like, you know, Chloe, it's just really hard when it is an invisible thing, and for people to understand, like your closest loved ones, to try and explain what you're going through. Like my partner probably didn't realize the extent of it until he had to drive me to the emergency department after having the cyst burst. Like we got outside and I was just spewing in the gutter, and he was just like, oh my God. I was like, we got to go to the hospital. And I just kept spewing. I was there for 13 hours, and that was a real eye-opening experience for him, that I was like, this is what it is. Like, it is what it is.
If you know anyone that's got endo or having issues, buy them a present. Buy How to Endo the Book.
Yeah.
By you, legend Bridget. And yeah, just thanks so much for sharing your story. So many, we have so many people that always talk and ask about endometriosis.
And we're always like, we don't really know how to speak about it. So yeah, we're so happy to have you on. And we're all about this in Darling Shine, just talking about these topics that people don't talk about. And you were a shining star.
Darling, gold shine. Star.
Your gold star award goes to you.
Yeah, you're a bloody lord. And like, so it is Endometriosis Awareness Month. What does that mean for you? What are you getting up to?
Honestly, I'm probably going to be laying a little low. I used to go all in with Endo Awareness Month And I guess, you know, I don't regret that, but it does take a bit of a toll on you. Like, there's a lot of emotional labor. And again, Chloe, like, I keep pointing to you, but I feel like you've probably felt this on the fertility front, like, and you're obviously so happy to talk about it, but there also comes a point where it's just like, oh, I just, like, you know, feel a bit fatigued from it. And when, I think also when people constantly come to you and then they like publish something and then they've just missed the mark. Mm. Like, they've just like not listened to you and you're just like, fuck me. Like, so yeah. I'm going to be laying low. This is probably the only thing that I'm doing for Endo Awareness Month is jumping on to talk with you guys, which more than happy to do, because like, you have such a powerful platform and I really appreciate you using it for good. And like, I know how many people in your community would be like navigating this kind of shit. And also, like, even when you were saying, like, I think this is another good point just to quickly highlight, like, when you say, like, we don't really know how to talk about it, in terms of like people who have it or people who don't have it, like, it's okay to not feel, and again, in terms of fertility as well, like, don't feel like because you don't know all the information that you can't start conversations and ask questions. And if you have a friend who's going through it, like, ask them, what is it like? Like, tell me, what is it like? What should I look out for? Like, how could I help you? As opposed to, you know, and I think in the, probably in the context of like miscarriages, for example, my first conversation about miscarriage was when I was 29 and I was so embarrassed because I just didn't know anything about it. And I didn't know what kind of questions to ask my friend who had gone through it. When you kind of prevent that conversation, it can make that person feel more isolated. But if you show that you're making that effort, that you want to know about it and that you can like acknowledge, hey, like, I don't know, or I can't imagine what you're going through, but like, I'm here to talk about it. I'm here to learn. Like, just that willingness can just go such a long way in terms of supporting someone if they're going through endo or, you know, fertility issues and stuff. So I think for everyone, for Endo Awareness Month, it's just like taking that time to listen and to read and to share stories, and don't be afraid to ask questions. So that's what I hope everyone gets out of it. That's what it probably means to me, is just like kind of, yeah, creating those conversations and normalizing it.
100% checking in on your friends. You never know what they're going through. Yeah. And you just often don't want to burden your friends. So you kind of do need to be asked those questions to be prompted to talk about it.
Totally, totally. Because it is hard. Like, you don't want to be like a vibe kill and be like, yeah, like, you know. So, yeah, it really does mean a lot for people to check in and be a bit more specific with like what they're asking. I feel like, because if you're like, how are you going, and we'll often be like, oh yeah, fine, because it's just like, I just don't even want to burden you with like what is going on.
Are you ready for this? Like, do you really want to know how I'm like, really fucking going?
Like, here we go. So I guess that kind of language being like, just being a bit more specific, like, how are you? Just be a bit more like, tell me, like, how are you feeling today? Or what's your pain like today? What does it feel like today? So you can be, maybe approach it in a more descriptive way, if that makes sense.
I feel like you've just taken the words right out of my mouth, and this is like the number one thing that I always say when speaking about infertility and all that, is educate yourself to be on the receiving end of that, to know that your friend's gone out of their way to educate themselves about what you're going through. That's just really puts a bit of a smile on your dial and just like, wow, that person really cares about me.
Yeah, totally. That's a good friend.
Educate.
Yeah.
Oh, Bridge, well, thank you so much for giving us your time, and hopefully we can all hang out in person.
Love that. You're a legend.
Oh, it'd be so fun. Absolutely would love to do that sometime. Like, I mean, I pop over east for a while.
Come to Perth. Like, yeah. We need to go. I've never been to Perth. Let's quickly pop over to Perth.
Yeah, skip across the Nullarbor. Let's go.
The Nullarbor. Thanks, Perth.
Let's leg it.
I'll meet you there.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.